This is Audible.
For additional material, please see the PDF that accompanies this program.
Chopo.
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 Chopo, we wrote a book. We made it good somehow. We wrote it just for you. So shut up and listen now.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Chapo Guide to Revolution, a manifesto against logic, facts, and reason. By Chapo Traphouse, Felix Biederman, Matt Christman, Brandon James, Will Miniker, and Virgil Texas. Read by the authors.
This book is dedicated to the brave Mujahideen fighters of Afghanistan.
Introduction. Borrow this book. For 2 years now, you've been asking, who is Chapo Traphouse? This is Chapo Traphouse speaking. We are Chapo, a podcast that loves life, coffee, doggos, bourbon, and intelligent debate. We are the podcast that does not sacrifice our love for those things or our values. We are the ironic pieces of shit who have deprived you of victims and thus destroyed your world with your own logic. If you wish to know why you're perishing, you who dread knowledge, we are the gang who will now tell you. If you're reading these words, you're likely living in despair and helplessness. You're fed a steady diet of thin, flavorless gruel by your leaders, your parents, fake friends who love drama, the fascist mods on Arrowhead, and the Celebrity Toes subreddit, the lying sheeple news media, and most especially, all previous works of political satire and comedy. You find yourself in the dumbest of all possible worlds. Clowns to the left of you, Rathuglicans to the right, and the president? How about no? Like a veal calf, you sit in your crate, every day growing sadder, softer, and more delicious, thinking, there's got to be a better way. Friend, we're here to tell you that there is a better way. The Chapo way. This is the beginning of a journey you will never forget. In this book, we'll survey the blasted landscape of contemporary American politics and culture through our scientific ideology of irony, half-baked Marxism, revolutionary discipline, NoFap November, and posting on the internet. You'll become an initiate in the Chapo mindset and take control of the neurons that govern your weak, fragile emotions. You will experience success, probably for the first time. You will learn to live your life on your terms. By buying this book and all its affiliated content, you'll improve your health and fitness, have stronger relationships, straighten your posture, purify your brain chemistry, and gain more focus. Your children and ex-wife will respect you. In addition to desiring to become a brain-clear alpha silverback gray wolf, you're probably also interested in politics and taking a sideways glance at the news through the lens of satire. Maybe you became politically aware one crisp, clear Tuesday morning in September when you got the day off from school. You noticed your GameStop clerk had tears in his eyes as he waived your late fee on Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six. Perhaps around the time America decided to invade Afghanistan and then Iraq, you had an inkling that living in the end of history wasn't going to be as utopian as promised. Maybe after John Kerry reported for duty at the 2004 Democratic Convention, you felt a brief twinge of patriotic embarrassment, followed by a bone-deep sense that things will never get better. Or maybe it was when you graduated from college with six figures of debt around the time the economy shit its insides out. It's possible you briefly lost that feeling of impending doom in 2008 after the likable, cool presidential candidate defeated the old man who slept through all his flight school classes. But that relief probably vanished in a wave of Wall Street bailouts and drone strikes and a brief Democratic congressional majority that didn't even bother to pass the card check bill or push for true universal health care. Perhaps once you got a job, you realized that the pay, or if you were really lucky, the benefits package, was vastly outweighed by what work took out of your soul, as you spent your days white-knuckling it from check to check, feeling like the same idiot failure you were before you had a job. In any case, the last presidential election probably left you completely lost, tossed about in the gaping maw of 21st century America. You're just another plastic bag adrift in the ocean, with no power, no future, and not even a symbolic say in politics. More bad news. Since 2016, the Democratic Party, the standard bearer of left-of-center policies like replacing unions with low-interest Uber loans and bringing charter school apps to Haiti, has stopped even pretending to fight for you. All this leaves a new power vacuum on the left, in which we have taken up residence. The mummies in the Democratic Party are busy trying to rebrand Clinton-esque bromides like entrepreneurship and education reform, while the average young working person is desperate for healthcare, free college, and a steady job that pays them in something other than Applebee's lunch combo coupons. Our case is simple. Capitalism, and the politics it spawns, is not working for anyone under 30 who is not a sociopath. It's not supposed to. The actual lived experience of the free market feels distinctly unfree. We'll tell you why, and offer a vision of a new world. One in which a person can post in the morning, game in the afternoon, and podcast after dinner, without ever becoming a poster, gamer, or podcaster. Bernie Sanders' unexpected victories in the 2016 primaries and Jeremy Corbyn's Labor Party's near upset nearly a year later revealed the false choice between the Democrats' bloodless liberalism and the lizard-brained right wing. You don't have to side with either the pear-shaped vampires of the right or the craven lanyard-wearing wonks of the center-left. Dark days lie ahead, and many people are finally hungry for a fully ironic ideology, for no good, entitled, downwardly mobile, politically hopeless millennials. More than anything, though, the current situation demands a huge expansion of what is considered realistic or possible. No, seriously, who are you? We are posters. We earn what we get in trade for what we post. We ask for nothing more or less than what we post. That is justice. What you call Chapo Trap House began as the brainchild of three chums who met on Twitter. In early 2016, Felix Biederman, Matt Christman, and Will Meneker sought a platform to discuss the upcoming election and also bring awareness to the disturbing presence of Dyson Airblades in most public restrooms. Did you know they actually spread 1,300 times more bacteria than simple paper towels? Soon after, Brendan James, Virgil Texas, and Amber Ali Frost came aboard. And despite the obvious lack of production value or the faintest tinge of professionalism, Chapo soon became a hit among dog fanciers, garnering profiles in prestigious old media outlets like The New York Gentleman, New York Place, Manhattan Times, The Knickerbocker, and Feet and Stream. Since then, our humble gabfest has become a Lovecraftian language virus, boring tunnels through the brains of all who encounter us. The important thing to remember is that, no matter who we are or where we came from, we invented leftism in America and are the only real socialists. If you encounter someone claiming otherwise, they're a Hitlerian NATO stalking horse running dog. Please record their name, address, and any other relevant details, and send it care of Chapo Emergency Commission for Combating Counter-Revolution and Sabotage, P.O. Box 42069, Penn Station, New York, New York, 10001. In order to guard against those kinds of revisionists, it's important to inculcate you, the reader, with the correct manifesto mindset. After you cut ties with your family and all your aforementioned fake friends, you'll be prepared to properly imbibe the lessons we're about to teach you. Go do that. Now, you may be asking yourself, Chapo, once you seize power, what will the country look like? Will all my favorite stories still be on television? Yes. However, you may notice a few changes when you're living in year zero of our utopia. The political program exists as follows. 1. 3-day work week, 4-hour work day. 2. Health care, child care, education, housing, and food are free and paid for by turning all existing billionaires into thousandaires and or Soylent. 3. The use of logic, facts, and reason is outlawed. 4. Feelings become fiat currency. 5. The police are replaced by robot cops of some kind. 6. Everyone gets a dog. 7. All drugs are legalized and also become safe, healthy, and non-addictive. 8. Every single person involved in creating, promoting, and planning the Iraq war is pushed into a volcano. 9. Control of all media, newspapers, journalism, etc., is turned over to a mysterious Big Brother-style figure known only as the Beer Nerd. 10. Official state religion is Shia Scientology. Things to come. In the chapters that follow, we'll act as Virgil Texas to your Dante on a tour of the hell realm of politics and culture. To kick things off in Chapter 1, we'll explain in a hasty and tossed-off manner the creation of the modern geopolitical scene. We'll analyze the nature and motivations of every major player on the global stage, based on only slightly outdated psychological profiles and phrenology. For example, in Russia, we see the incubator of the global right wing, which hacked America's election by installing Hillary Clinton as the 2016 Democratic nominee. In friendly France, we see a proud Enlightenment tradition that cherishes democracy and free expression, primarily through the medium of obscene, phallus-based political cartoons. The world is indeed complex, and is therefore boring. So we'll do our best to give you the information you need to craft global solutions for a global world. In Chapter 2, we'll examine the history and personality of the American lib. Everyone loves a liberal, or so they tell themselves, despite their practical cultural hegemony in movies, TV, and academia. Liberals have an uncanny knack for losing elections and being generally loathed. This is in spite of their strong record of liking ethnic food, bombing ethnic countries, privatizing education, and gutting welfare. This collection of punching bags and pratfall artists, whose only principle is not being Republican, have somehow fallen out of favor, despite being right about everything. How did this happen? Until the 1950s, the Communist Party had nearly succeeded in infiltrating the top levels of government, before Alger Hiss accidentally announced, "I'm a Soviet spy," during his son's Bring Your Dad to School Day. His unforced error triggered a purge that threw American radicals back into opposition through the 1960s, when they won some important victories for the civil rights and anti-war movements. They also scored several less important victories, like mainstreaming vegetarianism and inventing the blazer with jeans look. The 1970s produced only disappointment, from the breakdown of labor power to the incompetent McGovern campaign to the crypto-conservative evangelical presidency of Jimmy Carter. After Reagan primed the pump for the final stage of dystopia, amping up the war on drugs, sanitizing racial resentment, and perforating the last vestige of American union muscle, Bill Clinton rode into office and finished the job by passing welfare reform and a draconian crime bill, eviscerating consumer protections, and transferring huge amounts of political power to the super wealthy, all the while posing as a bleeding heart pinko. In fact, Clinton would have privatized Social Security and gotten away with it were it not for a certain meddling intern. That left us with the current incarnation of the Democratic Party, pro-war, pro-Wall Street, and pro-markets. In other words, despite their tepid and always negotiable commitment to abortion, gay rights, and prestige TV, they're as right-wing as any political party should be allowed to be in the 21st century. The fact that they're supposed to be decent people's only form of political representation is proof enough that we're living in hell. Is it any wonder that liberalism has become a dirty word and that the task of bringing socialism back has fallen to goofies like us? In the ongoing family court drama that is our politics, true patriots would cast the American lib as the scheming, greedy wife who, with the aid of anti-father laws and unelected judges, takes all the money and runs off with the scuba instructor, Europe, while the children, democracy, freedom, and liberty, suffer from neglect and slide into dissolution and juvenile delinquency, socialism. Who will stand for love, family, and what we once had on our wedding night all the way back in 1776? Who will stand athwart history and scream, "Stop turning the kids against me"? That lone hero is the subject of Chapter 3, the American conservative, or right-winger, who will fight for family and stand for what's right, even if it's uncool, unfashionable, or chattel slavery. In Chapter 4, we shoot the messenger, the media, who, in this torturous family court analogy, was friends with both liberals and conservatives in college before getting married and eventually divorced, and wants to remain friends with both parties. The media is the guardian of discourse. And in the future, the only media that will exist will, of course, be Chapo and Chapo-approved affiliates. We'll focus entirely on liquidating the legitimate news part of the media, along with its revolting acolytes known as journalists. In this chapter, however, we'll provide a history of the pre-revolutionary news media, from the early days of the printing press to the dawn of the blogosphere and beyond. Of course, it was once said by the great political satirist and cocaine enthusiast Andrew Breitbart that politics is downstream from culture. We're peeing in the same gutter. Before one can truly understand politics, one has to watch a lot of television shows and movies, especially those aimed at children. And Chapter 5 has you covered. In a broad survey of the dominant strains of contemporary culture, we destroy the fascist and imperialist aesthetic that rules our time. In its place, we offer you the correct cultural opinions and a slate of pre-approved films, TV shows, art, and sculpture. Finally, in Chapter 6, we roll up our sleeves, bring our lunch pail to the job site, and develop an opioid addiction after destroying our joints writing about how much jobs suck. From the agricultural labor that made the Fertile Crescent to the dark satanic content mills of today, work has always plagued humanity, sapping our energy and stealing time that could be better spent doing nothing. We'll dispense with many of the comforting myths about work that permeate our society, namely that small businesses and their owners are good, that hard work is its own reward, and that education, marriage, and skills represent a path out of exploitation and poverty. In addition, Chapter 6 will also touch on the most dynamic and exciting part of our economy, and therefore our politics, technology. It's the engine that drives innovation and disrupts all the old ways of being human. The tech industry has changed how we work, date, eat, and not have sex in the few hours between. But as the singularity approaches, we must face certain ethical and political quandaries, such as: what do we do with the surplus population put out of work by robots? And can we fuck those robots even if they become self-aware? That's pretty much it. Once you read this book, or listen to this audiobook, you will possess the mindset to participate in the vanguard of the coming revolution. Achieving a Chapo-run society will require revolutionary discipline, but make no mistake, the world will change when you're ready to pronounce this oath.
I swear by my life and my love of it that I will never live for the sake of another political comedy podcast, nor another shitty neoliberal Democratic Party candidate for fear of whatever right-wing ghoul they're running against.
One last thing. If you're a fan of sacred cows, prisoners being taken, and holds being barred, then stop reading immediately. This book is not for you. However, if you feel alienated, dispossessed, and disenfranchised, from the political and cultural nightmare that is America? Then Chapo, let's go.
Chapter 1. World. I am a citizen of the world. Diogenes. The world is a vampire. The Smashing Pumpkins. You may find it odd that we'd start a book about the American nightmare with a chapter on the rest of the world. You reveal your own ignorance. The great thing about having an empire is that no matter where you are on Earth, you're home. And you can't really understand America's internal rot, its inflamed, wriggling bowels, unless you understand its role as a brutal, stupid, and self-owning empire. But just how did America grow from a small-time mom-and-pop plantation into a gigantic, ruthlessly efficient multinational? After some initial growing pains, the United States debuted some innovative imperial pilot programs like Cuba and Hawaii in the late 19th century, but it wasn't until after World War II that we truly inherited Great Britain's mantle as the international point man for capital. America would soon end up invading, sabotaging, or destroying literally most of the countries in the world in pursuit of maximum synergy.
Hostile makeover. The U.S. emerged from World War II as the Chad of nations. The nation of Chad did not come into existence until 1960. Our rival Nazi Germany had collapsed after it overleveraged risky investments in Eastern European living space, while Japan, once an aggressive competitor to America, was defeated due to a certain killer app developed in a cutting-edge incubator in Los Alamos, New Mexico. Not only were our enemies out of the game, but our British, French, and Dutch colleagues were all bankrupt, leaving America ready to expand our portfolio and pick up these assets from declining empires for pennies on the dollar. To manage this sprawling enterprise, we reorganized our top talent into a streamlined corporate structure. The newly formed Defense Department was put in charge of human resources. The International Monetary Fund handled accounting using the Bretton Woods bookkeeping system. The CIA headed up marketing, underwriting radio spots in Eastern Europe, and some truly groundbreaking abstract advertisements by Mark Rothko and Jackson Pollock. And for R&D, we poached a team of bright young go-getters from a foundering competitor via Operation Paperclip, one of the most successful headhunting projects in the pre-LinkedIn era. Just as the modern economy consolidates hundreds or thousands of diverse firms into a handful of huge, pulsating conglomerates, America rode a wave of mergers and acquisitions to global monopoly. We got serious about vertical integration and started using our newfound economic and military muscle to close some really impressive deals in markets like Britain, West Germany, Japan, and, after deleting about a million people from the budget, Korea. Korea was the first serious PowerPoint presentation of the Cold War, a showdown between us and the oppressive regulatory apparatus known as the Soviet Union. It was where we first proved our commitment to the two principles of our company philosophy. A. Kill civilians to maintain U.S. hegemony, and B. Prop up dictators to maintain control of valuable territory. It's a simple process known as subcontracting, and it came in handy every time we needed to farm out the hard work of opening markets and killing communists. During the Korean War, for example, Syngman Rhee was our guy, a dapper, well-dressed player who ordered thousands of extrajudicial killings and had a dick like a billy club. And long after him, people tend to forget, South Korea was governed by a series of alternating military and civilian dictators. Korea set the standard. We'll do anything on behalf of anyone, especially on behalf of ourselves. That's the American promise. So straight out of the gate, the Cold War was emphatically not about democracy versus totalitarianism. In Korea and in every subsequent proxy war, it was about capitalism versus threat to capitalism. For a while, things hummed along nicely. By 1953, after the stuffy, uncreative Mohammad Mossadegh decided to nationalize Iran's oil industry, we paid Iranian bodybuilders to help install the pro-American Shah. In 1954, we acquired Guatemala through some corporate espionage. In 1965, we handed over an electronic mailing list of known communists to our business partner, Indonesia, which resulted in some serious house cleaning. And also in 1965, we occupied the Dominican Republic to bail out its pro-American CEO. Inevitably, however, the day arrived when public relations took a serious hit. The problem was Vietnam, a once promising leverage buyout from our faltering competitor, France. The whole thing started when the U.S. decided to cancel a national Vietnamese election scheduled for 1956 and set up by the Geneva Accords. America saw this mess of red tape for what it was and had the South Vietnamese call it off. That, rather than whatever slogan John McCain has tattooed on his scaled thigh, is what started the entire war. At the time, it seemed like a great investment. Even after assuming the previous company's liabilities, by the end of its run, America was funding about 80% of the French war in Indochina. These assets were going at fire sale prices. Much like Korea, we ended up outsourcing the management to a series of dictators. Ngo Dinh Diem, Big Min, Win Khan, etc. But despite our best efforts, we failed. The attempted hostile takeover killed something in the neighborhood of 3 to 4 million Vietnamese, and that's not even counting the spillover in Laos and Cambodia.
Seven Habits of Highly Effective Empires. It was a lesson for some, but not all, of America's board members. The ideal business relationship may not be direct, messy, bloody conflict, but instead a tranquil affiliation between contractor and subcontractor, a junior who acts on the whim of the parent yet still serves its own interests in the region. Corporate should only intervene if a bigger problem arises, such as uppity trade unions demanding labor laws or casual Fridays getting out of hand. Other people drew a different lesson. Every time a colonial overlord is forced by their declining economic standing to pull out of a country and leave a vacuum of power, that vacuum will almost certainly be filled by an anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist movement. You may be saying to yourself, hey, Professor Atheist Jew Libtard, put down the birth control pills and burning flag for 1 second and take the patriotic view. We were fighting a war to the death against communism. If we hadn't propped up our dictators, wouldn't they have propped up their dictators and won? Here's a two-tiered answer. First, who cares? Pick your dictatorship. Would you rather have lived in Fidel Castro's Cuba or in any one of the U.S.'s many military junta police states? Second, America was usually targeting not just strongman regimes, but democratic mass movements. And there was never a situation in which any American gain in yardage was a clear win against hegemonic communism because the communist bloc was already fragmented by the mid-1960s, not to mention the added players in the Third Way Non-Aligned Movement, which was a crunchy co-op founded by Nehru, Tito, Sukarno, Nasser, and Nkrumah. How many times did we act not against communism, but against anything remotely subverting capitalism? United Fruit in Latin America, Iran, democratically elected Chilean socialist Salvador Allende. In none of these cases were the Soviets to be seen. In fact, Allende was a complete pushover who decided to ignore some choice advice Castro gave him right before the coup. Put guns in the hands of the workers because they're coming to kill you. Allende's response, no, democratic norms are important, explains why his regime lasted a full 15 minutes while Fidel lived another 900 years. In fact, America was so interested in fighting the evils of communism that it propped up fucking Pol Pot after the killing fields. Yes, the genocide in Cambodia was stopped by the communists running North Vietnam, who drove Pol Pot out of power. But because the North Vietnamese were card-carrying Reds, America backed a Khmer Rouge comeback tour and sent SAS guys to train them in the jungles and lay mines that are still around today and probably just atomized some poor soul as you listen to this paragraph. Yet Pol Pot ends up in the Black Book of Communism. But such are the trade-offs inherent in running a business. And what a business we had. Funding wasn't a problem, seeing as the U.S. was a preeminent manufacturing base, the workhouse of the free world. With the Marshall Plan and a pivot toward Asia, we were throwing cash and goods everywhere, stabilizing our post-war partners in a new global order, and securing some profits for industry, if you want to be pedantic about it. Also, with the Bretton Woods system that established the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency of world trade, America entered the post-war era as the ultimate arbiter and guarantor of global capitalism. This meant that we could afford to spend billions rebuilding the European economy and keeping communists from taking power, while brokering peace between labor and capital at home. In exchange for chilling out on the worker militancy and purging communists from any leadership positions, organized labor was promised a bigger percentage of the profits generated by America's unipolar industrial might.
Schlock Doctrine. After a half century of gridlock, we finally got the upper hand against our big governmental rival in Russia. The breakthrough came in the late 80s after the Soviets tried to regulate small businesses in Afghanistan. Seizing the opportunity to innovate, we created a new platform for warfare that empowered independent contractors known as Mujahideen, who were looking to thrive in the gig economy. The inflexible bureaucracy of the Red Army, bogged down by licenses and worker benefits, simply couldn't compete. The beauty of our strategy lay in its simplicity. We could spend almost unlimited sums of money and create a whole slew of new jobs for self-motivated freelancers with very little screening or oversight. Sure, this led to our fair share of PR setbacks, including one-star reviews for unreliable contractors like Muhammad Atta, but that came further down the line. Then, in 1989, Ronald Reagan finally ended communism by boldly declaring, "Mother, where are my jelly beans?" shitting himself and karate chopping the Berlin Wall exactly four times. The combined pressures of falling oil prices, the invasion of Afghanistan, nationalist movements, and the internal contradictions of the Soviet system may have also played a role. With collapse on the horizon, Mikhail Gorbachev was stuck with a serious crisis. Thankfully for everyone, the West was eager to lend a helping hand. This was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to free the East from the tyranny of planned economies and government jobs. Thanks to the ambition and corruption of Boris Yeltsin, U.S. policymakers, and the chaos god Loki, the Soviet Union splintered into dozens of new independent startups, while America and her allies carried out an aggressive strategy for the acquisition of Eastern Europe's state assets. Yeltsin woke up on a snowmobile in 1999 with no memory of the previous 10 years. When he got back to his office in the Kremlin, his staff informed him that he'd sold off all Russia's resources to pirates, mob bosses, and Western corporate interests. Damning, to be sure, but don't act like you haven't done worse while drunk. Yeltsin facilitated a shock therapy economic liberalization program, otherwise known as private equity, assisted by American whiz kids like Jeffrey Sachs and Larry Summers. It led to the largest drop in peacetime life expectancy of the 20th century. But they got McDonald's and Pizza Hut, so it's a wash. Why live past 55 when you've already fulfilled your greatest dreams? Somehow, an epic deal like consumer goods in exchange for the privatization of your entire economy wasn't good enough for many Russians, and Yeltsin faced a difficult re-election campaign in 1996. A Communist Party candidate threatened to return Russia to the bad old days of guaranteed employment, free housing, and low infant mortality rates. Luckily, some American lanyards and a few $1 billion from oligarchs and Western interests helped swing the election for Yeltsin. He repaid the good faith of his country's citizens and the loans of his benefactors with more privatization, eventually handing power to former KGB officer and competitive CrossFitter Vladimir Putin. Putin proceeded to turn Russia into a supercharged version of America, with all the bigotry, inequality, and sham democracy that went along with it. When Putin's new souped-up national capitalist agro-state sought to reclaim the sphere of influence it had lost after the fall of communism, was the U.S. proud of the precious, rapacious child it had raised? No. First, Mitt Romney identified Russia as America's biggest global threat in 2012, and then, 4 years later, all the liberals who had giggled at that bit of backward-looking hysteria decided that Mitt was right after all, and that a good way to hashtag resist President Cheeto would be to send anti-aircraft missiles to the Babi Yar Reenactment Society in Ukraine. Some people in some countries just can't take yes for an answer.
Euro-America. With the former Soviet Union foreclosed on, the last real threat to American global hegemony had been eliminated. Except for the emerging public-private partnership of China, but how much of a threat could they ever become? The future looked bright enough to necessitate shades, so to speak. The final piece of the project was to create a single market out of the hodgepodge of fractious, cheese-producing nations in Europe. Once the danger of Soviet invasion was gone, the ruling classes could begin turning Europe into a slightly grimier version of Epcot. All the continent's distinct nationalisms with their meatballs and blackface Santas would be preserved as local flair, while economic and political power were centralized in the headquarters of the new European Union. Unfortunately for the globalist schemers, European national identity proved more resilient than anticipated, something Slobodan Milosevic could have told them in between genocides. So instead of going forward with political unification, dead on arrival, they went through the back door with a currency-based union, figuring that with time, the political institutions would catch up with the reality on the ground. But a funny thing happened on the way to the end of history. A financial crisis in 2008 that the euro system was completely incapable of handling. You can't totally blame them. They were told that capitalism had won and that this kind of thing really wasn't supposed to happen anymore. Despite that, the European Central Bank responded to the 08 crisis with a Wahhabist-style neoliberal austerity that even the moderate consensus makers in Washington did not have the stomach for. Cue permanent immiseration in the peripheral states of the euro, the so-called POGs, who couldn't devalue their currency to boost exports, and aid so-called labor reform in the rest of Europe. Today, Europe can be divided into the countries with sun, good weather, great food, and sex, but terrible economies, and those with great economies but total darkness, awful food, and even worse sex. However, all of Europe remains strongly united against male circumcision and, as such, is still far, far ahead of America. All this economic hardship, coupled with the spiraling refugee crisis and the continued inability of political institutions to address any of it, has led to a big retro trend across the continent. That's right. The 30s are back. Dance marathons, Art Deco, and the rise of organized fascist political movements.
You what, mate? Let us put aside this corporate fable of the American century and turn now to the world you know and love. At the time of this writing, the War on Terror is now in its 17th year, becoming, as NatSec intellectuals like to put it, a generational commitment. It has gone from the unprecedented, epic-defining focus of our national destiny to something we all just meekly accept and largely tune out as it hums along in the background as kids born in September 2001 reach military age. U.S. policy currently involves allying with the moderate elements of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban against newer, eviler kinds of terrorists and their state sponsors. Outside of this very easy and base irony, one can assess the value of the war on terror by entertaining a simple thought experiment. How much safer would both America and the rest of the world be right now if our government's response to 9/11 was to pretend it didn't happen and do absolutely nothing? Would the Middle East be the cauldron of violence it is today? Would ISIS exist? Would we witness the same number of terrorist attacks in Europe? Would a million or so people have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan? Almost certainly not. But remember, for the national security class and the small cadre of Ford administration has-beens who came to power before 9/11, all these details are features, not bugs, of the war on terror. The cascade of atrocities and disasters that issued forth from this U.S.-led crusade, from ISIS snuff films to sectarian bloodletting, to institutionalized torture, to mass surveillance, to the refugee crisis, to an American culture warped by militarism and troop worship, is just further justification for why we must stay the course. Your ability to safely work in an office building, go to a concert, run a marathon, take mass transit, or fly in an airplane free from any unplanned inconveniences is at best incidental and at worst actively hostile to the goals and logic of the war on terror. The thing we call the war on terror is, like pretty much every other war, a crude land grab for control of resources, oil pipelines, and good old-fashioned access to markets. The national security state used the pretext of 9/11 and the blowback from the Cold War as ways to drum up a chintzy version of the war economy from World War II and replace our fucked-up retail debt economy after we killed the golden goose of American industry and manufacturing. Now, we don't want to give you the impression that it's all just simply blood for oil. A great deal of the blood is indeed being exchanged for oil, but the people who dreamed up this never-ending story think American control of the world's oil supply is but a perk compared to restoring America's martial spirit and imperial vigor. The fact is, we've been gun-shy about being a great power since Vietnam and pathetically idle since the end of the Cold War robbed us of a worthy adversary. The Twin Towers imploding on national television was just what we needed to put some fire in our bellies, spring in our steps, and vengeance in our hearts. For a Straussian, endless and aimless struggle against evil is just what the doctor ordered for our hyper-individualized and alienated culture. Not to mention a great way to keep military budgets and their pleated trousers swole. The war on terror is the bathtub our empire lies in, surveying a sunset over a wheat field in the Cialis commercial that is our 21st century international statecraft. While pretty much any president, including the one who actually won the 2000 election, would have attacked Afghanistan after 9/11, only George W. Bush and company were in the right place at the right time to really get this bigger project off the ground. In the words of Donald Rumsfeld, Afghanistan lacked any good targets to obliterate, and so it was off to Iraq. They wanted a 21st century world stage dictated by American military might and refused to accept a multipolar world in which powers simply used diplomacy to jockey for advantage. For the neocons and the defense establishment, though, that would be heresy, because we have the biggest military in the world, and, in the words of Madeleine Albright, what's the point of having this superb military you're always talking about if we can't use it? Sure, America can negotiate with other powers, but always from a position of strength, i.e., a big military presence where all the oil is. Anyway, there's no point in litigating the Iraq War too much. It's the defining disaster of this new American century. It should be sufficient to say that the justifications for it, from weapons of mass destruction to any supposed concern for the freedom and well-being of the Iraqi people, were obvious confabulations that fooled only those who wanted to be conned and those who just didn't care because the thought of war excited them so much. This included pretty much all the media, government, and cultural elites of this country, and it remains the gold standard for how we should judge them. One demographic decidedly not fooled was black Americans, almost 70% of whom opposed the war out of some sense that America is actually kind of bad. Meanwhile, our thought leaders in the government and media stuck with it as bravely as they could through the rising body counts and the Abu Ghraib revelations until around 2007, when they were finally forced by Bush's top-to-bottom incompetence to give up the ghost. By then, everyone reluctantly realized that there wasn't going to be any good ending or VJ Day moment that would retroactively make their support of the Iraq War look noble or wise. They realized the money and credibility they invested in this project, clinched by a particularly impressive Herbalife presentation at the UN, was simply not coming back. However, this is America, and in our country, no dream ever really dies. In this case, we were able to swap out George W. Bush for General David Petraeus as 2007's figure of national leadership and competence, and trade mission accomplished for, the surge worked. And that was that. The Iraq War didn't demonstrate American might or benevolence on the global stage the way we might have hoped, nor did it inspire any new national purpose or credo. But it was no real loss either, because not a single person involved was ever held accountable, save for Chelsea Manning. And then, in 2008, we got Obama, the living refutation of swaggering idiot cowboys like Bush and snarling, sneering blood drinkers like Cheney. Nevertheless, Obama pulled off a much trickier job, Febrezing our national conscience without ever truly reckoning with what happened, or winding down our blood-soaked strategic interests in the region. Despite Obama's gloss as a liberal beacon of hope, this was the moment the war on terror stopped being an emotional spectacle in American life and became a new baseline for reality. It joined the background static of our society, with the imprimatur of both parties and therefore all acceptable points of view. It became something that simply is, existing perfectly outside the realm of politics and ideology. The days of boots on the ground and nation building were over, and the phrase war on terror now meant harnessing our technology to manage a global drone assassination campaign. We could even safely retire war on terror, as the thing itself no longer required a name. So thoroughly metastasized was it throughout our body politic. All this was far less upsetting for the public, the American public, that is, but all the more corrosive to our souls, precisely because of how invisible and consequence-free it now appears. Still, it should be noted that while they may be out of power for now, the architects of the War on Terror remain at large. They're ensconced in the Virginia and Maryland suburbs, in think tanks, op-ed sections, and on cable news. Some have even taken up positions as leaders of the hashtag resistance to President Trump. But none of them have lost hope for a new Pax Americana. Their mission remains the same. For these heroes in error, the real prize is still and always was Iran, the Islamic Republic, the Shia succubus. Iraq is just a Scrabble tile away from Iran, and while Saddam's old stomping ground was merely supposed to be a launching pad toward the rest of the Middle East, Iran was always the real treasure, the site of a new, glorious, liberated American dominion to print American Enterprise Institute pamphlets and pump petrodollars. Iran is our real enemy because, for our national security planners, it represents the unthinkable, a genuine regional power with its own oil resources outside the U.S. fold that isn't a complete basket case. As such, we're treated to the semi-regular cant that Iran is the greatest exporter of terrorism in the world, and, even more galling considering who's saying it, that it's meddling in the region and is a threat to its neighbors. This is also why it's considered gauche to bring up Saudi Arabia's state sponsorship of terrorism and Wahhabism. For American NatSec intellectuals, be they of the Brookings Institution or the American Enterprise Institute, killing 3,000 Americans and engineering the worst famine of the 21st century in Yemen is far more forgivable than getting away with an Islamic revolution for 40 years. This is why Saudi Arabia remains in good standing in the media and think tank zone, despite being patient zero for Islamic fundamentalism and terror.
The end of the world chapter as we know it. Conservative pundits love to compare America to Rome, mainly because they want to be allowed to drape sheets around their asses and bring back slavery and man-boy love. But that doesn't mean it's not a useful analogy. Like Rome, we're a deluded and decadent empire in terminal decline. After a brief post-war golden era for white people, the end of the 20th century saw America open up the world economy so much that we stopped making things at all and just started buying them elsewhere to support our British, German, and South Asian pals. Nowadays, it's other people who make things, not least our erstwhile communist enemy, China. Despite the gaudy, ongoing celebrations of American exceptionalism, this country has been reduced to being the military arm of international capital, demoted from manager to rent-a-cop. Everything's on credit with a precarious and doomed balance between military spending and domestic debt. Meanwhile, China, carved up by Europe in the 19th century, expelled those powers in the 20th. They kicked off this century with a supercharged state-guided capitalism that's carrying out the most mind-boggling planned industrialization in world history. Footnote, from 1901 to 2000, America used 4.5 billion tons of cement. A couple years ago, China started buying a lot of cement. They went through 6.6 billion tons in just 3 years. Analysts fear that by the end of the decade, China will have more half-pipes per capita than the U.S. They're developing domestic markets, not just exports, and starting up their own imperial designs in Africa, the last remaining spot on the planet yet to be turned into a base for cheap industrial manufacturing. In 20 years, that pang you get when you see made in China on a clothing tag will be replaced by a wince from seeing made in Africa. And it may even sting a little more. But China is doing just what America's done, what the world's been doing for the last 200-odd years, consuming and growing more and more each year with no end in sight, driven by a deep, deep madness. So brace yourself for a lot more talk about a showdown between democratic Western values and mammoth red communist China. And remember that it's all total horseshit. It's just cover for a desperate scramble for resources on our wheezing, dying planet, as every country's elites pile up last bits of obscene wealth to better withstand the inevitable collapse. And what a collapse it'll be! As Thomas Friedman pointed out in his thought-provoking bestseller, Our Interconnected World, the world is more interconnected than ever. Ideas, capital, racist memes, and state repression flow through borders at the speed of imagination. Thanks to the digital revolution, a neo-Nazi in Budapest can now obtain a list of local Roma and their addresses from an anime-obsessed hacker in Kazan City on a platform funded by a paleo-libertarian transhumanist venture capitalist in San Jose, who is at that instant explaining the plot of Atlas Shrugged to a yawning high-class cam girl in Johannesburg, all at the click of a button. For you and the transnational ruling class, this means that world capitalism is churning towards its brutal denouement at maximum efficiency. Yes, the world's future is a veritable choose-your-own-adventure of impending cataclysms. Runaway wealth inequality dramatically expands the underclass as nations race to the bottom to cut wages in a futile effort to slam the brakes on the inexorably falling rate of profit. Throw in resource scarcity and overconsumption, and we get rationing of basic human necessities among the global poor and outrage among the Western upper classes when the rare earth metals needed to manufacture their animatronic Boss Baby-themed merchandise have been exhausted. Or we could just have a good old-fashioned global economic depression once the cheap credit house of cards falls over. Of course, no roster of anticipatable apocalypses would be complete without the total ecological collapse caused by climate change. It turns out that 2 centuries of spewing industrial effluvium into the atmosphere to power the modern world wasn't without its consequences. At the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was around 280 parts per million. As of this writing, we're over 410 parts per million and rising. The concentration limit needed to prevent irreversible ecological damage is, way less than that. To be fair, it may be all right, as fossil fuel industry scientists point out, that the Earth's atmosphere had similar CO2 concentrations during such periods as the solar death epoch and the uninhabitable era, a misleading name given the various genera of bedbug that prospered during this period. We aren't looking to cause a panic or anything, but to be perfectly honest, you should put your headphones down right now and look up the cost of a decommissioned missile silo in Svalbard. We don't have to tell you what climate change has wrought. You see the headlines on the Weather Channel website when you're just trying to find out whether you need an umbrella today. It's a 5 to 7 degree Fahrenheit increase in the global mean temperature, and that's if we do nothing. Ocean acidification, permanent end to Red Lobster's Crab Fest, 0.5 meter or so of sea level rise, which has already inundated a few insular countries, destruction of millions of acres of arable land, increased property values in the Yukon territory, food insecurity, water insecurity, the return of ancient comic book villain origin story caliber diseases unearthed from melted permafrost, immensely destructive tropical storms that cause precipitous drops in approval ratings for Republican administrations, sharp reduction of biodiversity, albedo effect, feedback loop, polar ice caps melting, malaria, war, refugees, Lenny Bruce is not afraid. People talk about the coming apocalypse. Take a closer look. The apocalypse is Puerto Rico annihilated by a hurricane. Its villages in India and Bangladesh and Nepal tortured by lethal flooding. The apocalypse is already here. You just don't live there yet. Not too long ago, scientists agreed that a global temperature increase of 2 degrees Celsius was the absolute upper limit for preventing environmental catastrophe. This was the starting point for global negotiations to reduce carbon emissions. The international community, fully cognizant of the consequences of their actions, as directed by the United States and rising countries like China and India, who felt left out of the first industrial revolution, said eat my ass and ignore the warnings. The cutthroat cost-benefit analysis they offered was that transitioning to clean, renewable sources of energy would slow down economic development to an unacceptable extent. China and India wanted to know why they couldn't litter their countryside with CO2-spewing coal-burning power plants when countries like America and Britain built their wealth and colonial empires in the past century doing the same. And developing countries in places like Africa and Central America that have never enjoyed the fruits of a stupid consumerist society like ours had a thing or two to say about their resources being pillaged and their environment being destroyed to ensure that middle-class Americans and Chinese can afford chatterbait tokens. If a bleeding heart, cuck, socialist, atheist, liberal professor were to become president of the United States, even they wouldn't have the moral authority to say to people living in the slumdog millionaire reality, You know what? We may have had our heyday stealing your resources and spewing noxious gases into the atmosphere to build a rich and entitled middle class, but you guys need to knock it off because the insurance premiums on our beachfront condos are getting out of control. And that's if the American ruling class wanted to do something about climate change. Europe, populated as it is with self-loathing, environment-loving sexual deviants, has tried to do its part, starting with a continental cap-and-trade market that has accomplished little more than making bicyclists in Amsterdam feel smug and reducing the spot price of crude oil so that developing countries can get cheaper, dirty energy. Of course, that's before the U.S. pulled out of the already watered-down and woefully insufficient Paris Agreement altogether. So peace out, globalists. You can take away my diesel-burning backyard smelter when you pry it from my cold, dead hands. Nobody wants to deal with the hangover from 2 centuries of untrammeled environmental extermination. Every earnest attempt at even ameliorating the effects of climate change has failed dramatically, and each time someone tried, global capitalism snuck away with cookie crumbs on its face, pausing only to make a cutesy, who, me, face to the camera right as another Bangladeshi village got buried in mudslides. Capitalism would be moribund even in the absence of all this. Climate change just gives an exciting breakneck life and death impetus to this struggle coming down the pike. It's the splash mountain of teleologies. The dislocations created by climate change helpfully remind us that the political systems we live under are incapable of solving any fundamental problems or acting in the interests of anyone but the ruling class. And no number of bright-eyed Brookings Institution-trained technocrats can change that. I ain't blogging anymore. As business mindset futurist experts, we can tell you that these trends will lead to more nationalism, more terrorism, more weapons, more wars, more fracturing of the creaky global order in which the real enemies of humanity will never be identified so long as there's an inexhaustible supply of people who don't look like you to scapegoat, and more walls put up by rich countries to keep out those folks lining up just to get down. And if the global order can't even get its act together to forestall an imminent threat to its own survival, what should make you think it could handle any number of looming self-inflicted technological crises? Take a moment to imagine what new and exciting crowd control weapons Elon Musk will sell to your government in the next few years. Think about what every country now understands about the human genome and what biological weapons will exist by the end of the next decade. The United States already spends well over $500 billion a year on its military to defend against what? Obviously, a handful of nukes alone would be enough to ward off any attempt to violate our territorial integrity, but goddammit, we need more to maintain our imperial dominion over a shrinking segment of a dying world. The rest of the global populace is still, understandably, not happy about this state of affairs. For how long is this situation tenable? You don't have to be the main character in the first third of a young adult novel to realize we're going to end up in a very bad place. We're sure that you, the idiot listener so stupid as to buy this audiobook, can imagine a global order built on egalitarianism, one in which the productive forces of society aren't spent on inventing new weapons of mass destruction and clever ways to brutalize dissidents, but on ensuring that all people enjoy the fruits of their birthrights, an order that holds human beings and their fundamental rights as sacrosanct, that believes the provision of basic human needs to be the sole objective of politics and the economy, that rejects violence and militarism in toto. But that's not your world. Sorry to bum you out. The rest of this book is kind of funny, though.
CTH World Factbook. This quick reference guide provides all the information you need to know about global hotspots and allies should you visit any of these countries for business, pleasure, espionage, or to spread the message about our podcast. Turkey. Population, 81.5 million subscribers to our show. Top-rated TV show, The Armenians in Gratitude, on the Comedy Mosque Network. Most downloaded apps, Angry Kurds, Erdogan Go, and Dissident Crush. Cause of all problems, Fethullah Gulen. U.S. stance, willing to barter Gulen for national treasure Denise, the roundest cat in Turkey. Saudi Arabia, population, 268 billion barrels. Top-rated TV show, Daughter Auction Hunters on Divine True TV. Political up-and-comers. Prince Sultan bin Faisal Abdulaziz Al Saud. Age, 86. A bloody scimitar. A platinum-coated Lamborghini with a machine gun mounted on the hood. National slogan. Oh, Lebanese sweetie, I love the feet. Come to Riyadh, I live in a castle. U.S. stance.